Prime Time Replay from Money FM 89.3. Read with Michelle Martin.
I'm reading a gripping long short story or short novel with a sharp grasp of human nature. I enjoy intricate speculative fiction with a sense of flawed humanity at its heart. And it helps if there's a puzzle box element to keep me turning the page, which is what I enjoyed about reading The Diary of One Who Disappeared. Jason Eric Lundberg's first work of long form fiction. He is a noted fiction editor from Epigram Books. He is a founding editor of Lonta, and I'll let him cue you into what that is and how it's contributed to speculative fiction in Southeast Asia in a while. Since coming to Singapore in 2007, he's written novels and children's books and edited anthologies, but this is his first work of long-form fiction. Welcome to Read, Jason.
Thank you very much, Michelle. I'm happy to be here.
Congratulations on Diary of One Who Disappeared. I like to get into a book through its title sometimes.
Right.
I looked it up and there is a there is a song cycle written by a Czech composer of the same name.
That's right. Yeah, Leoš Janáček. So this was a song cycle that was, I don't know a whole lot about it. I can't talk, expertly about it, but it was an influence on at least the titling of the book and some of the framing of the book as I was working on it. But it's about a young man who meets a gypsy girl and falls in love. And, it's a love story, and he also...
There's a lot of unrequited love.
Right, right. Mm. And he ends up kind of going off with her at the very end. And so what was interesting when I came across this, I had actually started working on the novella and then came across this title, and I noticed that it was actually, the thing that actually struck me was that it's very similar to the subtitle for Franz Kafka's first novel, America, which is called The Man Who Disappeared. And so the kind of the similarity of those two was really striking to me, and it felt like this was something that I could actually apply to the story that I was trying to tell as well.
And Kafka's America is referenced in this book.
It sure is, yes.
So the year is 2040. An envoy of the North American Union finds himself a fugitive in the Southeast Asian island nation of Tin Hau, which I particularly enjoyed because there is a place in Tin Hau for laksa.
That's right.
Tell us about these worlds.
Yeah, so this takes place in, it's not our own world, so it's an alternate world. So the North American Union is a combination of, it's a kind of a borderless combination of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And Tin Hau is basically their version of Singapore. So it was a way to actually kind of talk about both the United States and Singapore in a slanted way, in a way that's not as obvious as if you were going to be writing specifically about the United States and Singapore. So this alternate world also, it has to do, I'm not going to spoil it, but it has to do with some doings that happen a little later in the book as well. But I also really like that idea of telling a story it's not quite our world, but it has enough in common with it that we can look at the world around us in a new way.
Do you think sci-fi or speculative fiction's love affair with the multiverse will never die?
I hope not. I mean, it's something that's, it's a really fun thought experiment, and it's really fun to play with as a creator, as a writer. Mm. And just things like Into the Spider-Verse, that just came out, that won an Academy Award. And I love that movie. It's a fantastic movie. And so it's something that a lot of people really enjoy, this idea of the multiverse, of different universes or different worlds that kind of split off from the one that we know. And as a writer, it's always very fun to kind of play in that sandbox.
Now, your day job is finessing other people's writing. Mm. As a noted book editor, how have you used your genre and editorial experience when it comes to your own writing?
Well, it's strange because it's almost like there are different parts of the brain that are working. So when I'm editing, it's a very analytical part. So I'm trying to, it's almost problem solving. So you're trying to figure out what's going on with this piece of text it's not quite where it should be, and figuring out the ways to hopefully to get it there or to suggest those to the author. And so when it's my own writing, it's much more of a creative type of process. And so it's much more about kind of getting into the story and figuring out what is going on with this main character that we've got. How can we put him in some interesting situations? And have some, something resolved by the end of it. And so it's not the analytical part of it is mostly just turned off. So when you're creating, you really want to turn that part of your brain off, because if you are analyzing every single thing that you're writing down, you're never going to get it done.
Yeah.
So it's that part of the brain is very active when I'm writing. And so when I'm editing, I have to do much more problem solving. And then when it comes to my own work, I have to do that as well. So even before it got to the editor, my colleague at Epigram Books, Eldis Tran, who edited this this novella, even before it got to her, I had to go through several different rounds of self-editing. And you're never going to see all the mistakes yourself, because it's like seeing the forest for the trees. You're never going to spot all of the different mistakes or the things that are not quite working. You always need somebody else to bounce that off of you. So even with that, I still needed Eldis's help. I needed the help of there was an editor that I worked with in New York, Juliet Ullman, as well, and she helped me get through a lot of this stuff too. So I recognize that being an editor, I recognize how important that part of the process is, the editing process, in kind of distilling what you're trying to say as the author and make it basically to elevate it to its best version. And so I, as an editor and also as a writer who has worked with editors, I'm very, very much in favor of that part of the process.
Tell us, what is happening with the main character, Lucas Lehrer?
Well, he's a guy, as we were talking about before, he's a guy that comes from the North American Union. He's a civil servant, and he is someone who is also kind of secretly an advocate for a certain group of people that are there. This is one of the parts of the world building of the novella, is that there is there's another group of people that are born with superpowers kind of all over the world. And in the North American Union at this time, they've actually been subjugated. They've been imprisoned, basically in concentration camps. And so he is trying to basically get them out of those concentration camps, get them into full society once again. And so he feels that if he and his boss, they feel that if they're able to create an alliance between the North American Union and Tin Hao, which is where he's going to go, that'll help put pressure on his own government to help either release or at least better the situation of these people in his own country, because Tin Hao is very enlightened in this way. They're very accepting of these type of people in their own country called Suis. And so they're treated as full citizens. They're treated as valuable parts of society. And so he wants to be able to put pressure on his own government by creating this alliance.
So you've lived in Singapore for the last 12 years. You were born
That's
in
right.
Brooklyn. You grew up in North Carolina. What is it about the experience of the emigree that you wanted to explore in this book?
I think specifically, I don't want to say anything too general. It's more of my own kind of experience, because there are people that are far smarter than me that can do that. So, but in terms of my own experience, it was a lot about how it is to adapt to a new country that is not your own. When I moved to Singapore, I didn't have a job lined up. I was staying with my ex-wife's parents, and so we kind of came here just hoping things would work out, and thankfully they did. But there were a lot of things along the way, a lot of culture shocks that I ran into along the way that were very interesting to me and unexpected to me, things that I had to get used to. And so that kind of experience of, especially of a Westerner coming to Asia in particular, and not doing it in an exoticized kind of exploitative way that has been kind of traditionally the way that narrative goes, I didn't want to do that. And so it's more about how he integrates into this new home of his and becomes, another part of that society himself.
So this book is written with a 2013 creation grant, I understand.
Right, right.
Why is marital discord the primary tension in this book?
I think it's one of the primary tensions. And I think part of it is that as I was writing the novella, so as you say, I was awarded the 2013 creation grant by the National Arts Council. And so while I was working on this, I was also going through a divorce as well. And so this was something that by putting this in the book, it actually did two things for me. One, it enabled me to kind of get away from my everyday experience and kind of sink into this fictional world as I was working on it. And the second thing was that it enabled me to kind of express what I was going through kind of emotionally through the character of Lucas, who is the main character of the book, because he is also going through the same kind of disruption to his own marriage. So it did both of those things, and it was very valuable in that way because it enabled me to – it was one of the things that helped me to get through that process myself. Because I was able to kind of use it in the fiction in that way.
Yeah, on many levels, there's a sense of upheaval, whether it's displacement or moral upheaval.
Right.
Or there's a sense of religiosity associated with the now, the North American Union, for example, which I found interesting. But coming back to that point of the creation grant, when you're writing knowing that you're a recipient of a grant, does that limit you in any way?
In this case, it actually didn't. It was actually pretty liberating because it's a financial help. So when you apply for
but
a grant
Singapore's
like this,
almost like a character in this novel.
It is in a way. I mean, it's through a kind of distorted lens, but it is in a way. You're right. But there was never any feedback from the National Arts Council that I should change certain parts of the novel because they didn't fit to a certain narrative. It was nothing like that. So I felt like I was free to tell the story that I needed to tell. And I also had that buffer of the financial help that I got from the grant that I was able to during some of that time, I was out of work. And so I was trying to work on that while I was doing other things, freelance and things like that. So it was something that actually helped me to make a living while I was working on it as well.
Were there contemporary political shifts that struck you as worth thinking through in this book? And are you that sort of writer who thinks through things as you write?
I hope so. I think to kind of reposition that, is something where I tend not to know what I'm thinking about something until I write it.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It's something where the writing actually is the way for me to explore what I actually think about things. So I hope I'm a thoughtful person, but, the writing process itself is very helpful for me to actually figure out what I think about things. So,
You can't help but notice that you touch on the theme of the rise of the strongman government.
True, yes. Yeah, the president of the North American Union in the novel is a very Trumpian president. He has a lot of things in common with him. And so there are a lot of things that I comment on in the book that I'm seeing very much in my own home country right now and have for the last few years. And so it's something where when I originally finished writing the novella, I finished in 2014 initially. And it's 5 years later, and so the world is a very different place. And so through the editorial process, I actually had to change things a little bit, well, actually more than a little bit, in order to basically comment on the world that we're living now. So that was something that I did feel was important because it's something that it's not just the U.S., the whole world is living through this period right now. And so it's something that concerns me very much, and so it's something that I felt like the main character would need to actually deal with on his own, too.
Who did you write this for?
Oh, well, I didn't have anybody specifically in mind. I mean,
so when you think of an audience or do you think of a reader?
I mean, my ideal reader is me. So if I'm entertained, if I get something out of it, then that's the big goal. So hopefully enough people will share that. As they're reading it and go, okay, well, this isn't just total garbage. and they'll enjoy it as well. But my primary reader is my ideal reader is me. This is something that, and I've heard many other writers say this as well, is that they wrote the book because it didn't exist already. So they wanted to see it out in the world. And I'm the same way, is this was something that I felt like it should exist in the world and it didn't already. So I had to write it myself. So that's always kind of where I start.
A slight tangent to that, I suppose, is why do you write?
Why do I write? Well, that's not an easy question to answer. It's something that I kind of constantly grapple with. The early answer, like when I was kind of early on in my career and a beginning writer, was just because I felt like I wanted to tell stories. I felt like that was one of the most important things that human beings can do, is to tell stories about each other. And so it's in terms of how I feel about it now, it is kind of the way that I feel is the best way for me to express myself and to kind of figure out the world around me. As I said, is I don't always understand what I think until I'm writing about it. So to actually do that writing and to have that part of the process is also very helpful for me in that way.
I just shot a documentary with a prodigy in Singapore. She's a violinist. Mm. And we were talking about her work, being an arts educator, sort of having to develop an audience because she finds herself constantly having to affirm the need for art. I mean, there is no need for art, but she's constantly having to reaffirm the value of art in order to have an audience or, you know, to be able to work in this society.
It's one thing that I see a lot here as well in Singapore specifically is that a lot of the arts are, if they're not commodified in some way, if you can't put a dollar value on them, then a lot of people think, well, what's the point? And they're missing the point. They're totally missing the point is that the arts are not there to just be a money-making thing. They are there to enhance who we are as human beings. And so it's important in terms of I feel the same thing that violinist feels is that, you know, why should I bother doing this? You know, what's the point? How is the world going to be better with me doing this? And what's been interesting to me as I've kind of gone through my career is I've actually run into people who have read my books and have talked about how it impacted them, how it affected them. And I think, okay, well, that's it. I've connected with that person. I've actually made a connection with a stranger, a total stranger that I didn't know before. And I was able to, through whatever I wrote, I was able to affect them emotionally, personally in that way.
A theme that we saw you write about in the last journal of Lontar was the value of kindness.
That's right, yeah.
Is that something that you explore here as well?
It is. It's something where, both in a societal way, but also in a personal way as well, is that the character of Lucas, he goes through a lot. He has a pretty rough time in this book. and so that's one thing that kind of they tell you in writing classes and things is to put your characters, you know, through the ringer. And so he does. He has a lot of things that happened to him that kind of upend his life.
Does this book reaffirm kindness?
Does it reaffirm kindness, yes. So because of kind of all the stuff that he goes through and one part of it as well is that he is you see a little bit of this in kind of the background. You see a little bit of it on a page, but he is emotionally abused by his wife. You know that he's going through this this dissolution of his marriage. He has been emotionally abused by her, and so there is a part of him that feels like he's kind of worthless. That he's down on himself, and that affects how he reacts in situations and how he carries himself. And so this is again something where. Throughout the book, as he's going through the different events that happen, he becomes kinder to himself. So he realizes, for one thing, that he is not a worthless person, that he actually does have value and he deserves to exist in the world just as much as anybody else. So I think it all begins there. It all begins with the personal kindness to be kinder to yourself. And when you can do that, then you can extend that kindness to the people around you and hopefully it builds from there.
We're fresh out of time, but congratulations on your novella. Diary of One Who Disappeared will be launched this Saturday at Kinokuniya. You can turn up and meet Jason Eric Lundberg yourself. This has been Reed. I'm Michelle Martin.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.